Blog Talk Radio.
Reading today from October 2015, Esquire Magazine. Interacting with the ladies. Advice we mostly no longer follow. How to handle a cat fight. When I see one of these coming on, I first remove all loose objects from the bar, such as ashtrays, glasses, bottles, and plates. May 1934. 2015 update. Invest in a break-resistant glassware when the fight occurs, quietly back out of the room. How to lie successfully to a woman. Keep it short, simple, and emphatic. Over-elaborate prevarication will arouse instant suspicion of her self-respecting. Will impel her to trap you. July 1962. 2015 update. Not lying also works. How to get off a train or a bus with a woman. Unless she's bigger and stronger, the man should always precede the woman off the bus and train so she can turn back to help offer a helping hand. May 1985. 2015 update. Turns out women know how to get on and off buses and trains by themselves. How to compliment a woman. Don't compare her with those other women. Blatantly tactless is always the thought my wife had the best. Eyes, breasts, legs, etc. But yours are terrific. May 1982. 2015 update. We've got nothing. Solid advice. The Internet. The parallel universe of information has dissolved all meaningful communication into an indifferential mass of content. Oh well, Esquire stepped into the parallel universe in 1995 along with the New York Times, eBay, and Amazon with the launch of its first website. Readers could click on Esquire's favorite hot links to roam online from site to site. These hot links are what the web's all about. Who you are is reflected by the links listed on your homepage. That's the whole point, to get a point of presence. Among the links, Paul's Hot Tub, a site that tracks the water temperature of a hot tub, presumably owned by the man Paul, in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Happy 20th anniversary. Okay, turn the page in here. Steve Jobs. What is generally considered the best, last, and most intimate profile of Jobs published in the magazine was written by Joe Nocera for the December 88th issue, The Second Coming of Steve Jobs. Jobs had been fired by Apple a little more than a year earlier and was starting a new computer company Next. One moment he's kneeling in his chair, the next minute he's slouching in it. By the next, he has leapt out of his chair entirely and is scribbling on a blackboard directly behind him. He's full of mannerisms. He bites his nails. He stares with unnerving eagerness or earnestness at whoever is speaking. His hands, which are slightly and inexplicably yellow, are in constant motion, pushing back his hair, propping up his chin, buried snugly under his armpits. When he hears something that intrigues him, he curls his head toward his shoulder and leans forward and allows a slight smile to cross his lips. When he's heard something he dislikes, he squints to register his disapproval. He would not be a good poker player. His speech is also mannered, but full of slangy phrases. If we could pull this off, he says enthusiastically, it would be really, really neat. The original idea was good, saying about a failed project. I don't know what happened. I guess somebody up there bozoed out. Around the room, there are knowing smirks. Bozo is a favorite Jobs verb, but where he once used it mainly to describe some of the stupidity perpetrated by, say, IBM, he now uses it just as often when he's talking about Apple. In the 2008 Esquire, Jobs again without his cooperation or with his, without his cooperation on the occasion of his first public appearance in several months at Apple's annual World Developers Conference amid rumors about his health. Steve Jobs and the portal are to the invisible. That's why the spectacle of Steve Jobs introducing the iPhone 3G in June was so moving. It wasn't just about he was withered, that his black mock turtleneck was bunching up like a flag across the listless day. It was Steve Jobs withering within the idea of himself. Gaunt as a pirate, dressed in what heretofore had been vestments of his vulnerability, he was speaking about the voice of a boy inventor from Mickey Rooney movie. He was still talking about Apple's really beautiful products. He was the alpha adolescence. He was still making his bid the only way he knew how. And the bid for immortality, for influence, for multiplication of himself, both within and without the terms of himself, was in the form of improved iPhones. There in the palm of his hand, which is precisely where he always wanted it, except it was clear in this case he'd started something he might not be able to finish. Not just because he was so sick, but because the iPhone now was so alive. Just a little more from Woes. Blue Box, Secrets of the Little. A teenage Steve Jobs and his Berkeley student friend Steve Wozniak were obsessed with blue boxes, electronic devices that could hack into long-distance lines for free by mimicking the phone company's high-frequency tones. Wozniak used it for prank calls, among other things. He once called the Vatican, presenting himself to be Henry Kissinger, and almost got to the Pope before a suspicious bishop called the real Henry Kissinger. But it also became Jobs and Wozniak's business. So Steve said, "How much does it cost to build it?" Wozniak recalls, and I said, $75. He said, we could sell it for $150. Back then, it was like $1,000 to $1,500 today. How could that be? They went into the Berkeley dorm room and sold their illegal loot boxes for $150. We'd do a presentation where I was talking about MC, where I was the MC talking about all the folklore of phone freaking. Steve was there to do the sales and money. You've read books about Steve Jobs' version, and I and Steve Jobs 2, and this was Steve Jobs 0. But noisy. Air conditioner there. Okay. John Kennedy. There no longer exists a photograph for which he is not immaculate. Take the Esquire cover from 1973, 10 years after his death. The shirt he was wearing while eating ice cream cone on a summer day is somehow ideal for a shirt for eating ice cream on a summer holiday. He was more than a classic, more than an icon of style. He was a specimen of casual elegance whose nonchalance was always almost cosmic. And America basked greatly in the reflected glow of that perfect competence. It made him president, and it made him the ideal subject for Esquire magazine. The remote glamour of John F. Kennedy has been amplified over the half century since his death. In 2015, he was separated. He's as separated from real life as the carved saint of the medieval cathedral. Ask who he really was, and the answer is pretty gauzy. Since from the sense of the new frontier and American tragedy, idealism destroyed. His glamour cloaks him from an aura of invulnerable splendor. At best, he's half story, half myth today. But if you want to find him in the flesh at a time before he was a pure iconic crappy. The page of Esquire magazine are where to turn. Very early on, we, even before his 1960 presidential bid, Esquire writers had a strange vulnerability in the man. In 1957, I turn the page again. 1957 piece, Who Will Win in 1960, he was singled out for the novelty of his triumphant appearance on the television at the Democratic Convention in 1956. He reached the publicity stratosphere with one rocket burst of television and stayed there, floating effortlessly like a satellite, wearing the hell out of the other earthbound Democratic hopefuls. Even when they knew that this strange suspension of gravity in American politics was only temporary, time consumes Kennedy's greatest asset, youth, the headline declared in 1959. Little did the writer know how accurate that prediction was. Camelot was always built in the clouds even before it was built in 1960. Norman Mailer described JFK as the first hipster candidate and recognized a mixture of hope and trepidation, the birth of a new style of politics revolving around his appearance on the Superman Comes to the Supermarket. Mailer detected a strange depression hovering over the delegates at the 1960 Democratic Convention, which at first had given the allure of a man they were there to nominate seemed inexplicable. Mailer saw Kennedy himself. I understood the mood of depression that had lain over the convention because it was simple. The Democrats were going to nominate a man who, no matter how serious his dedication might be, was indisputably, willy-nilly going to be seen as a great box office actor. And the consequences of that were staggering and not all that easy to calculate. The reality was being swallowed us had swallowed us so thoroughly for so long that we could no longer see it properly. It's worth remembering nonetheless, there was a time when Americans elected their candidates for qualities other than image, the time before Kennedy. Celebrity culture overwhelmed political culture. Kennedy and his family, a collection of catastrophes somehow described as a dynasty, satisfied the Democratic people's eager craving for aristocracy. His assassination made it impossible to prevent his elevation into an American deity. That moment of death and resurrection was reflected in Esquire 2 in January 1964. An issue was at the printing press when Kennedy was killed. Desperate editors blocked the Kennedy jokes in the dubious achievement with blue ink. In June 1964, Tom Wicker wrote Kennedy Without Tears, an act of resistance to the myth-making that was underway. It was the last possible moment to point out Kennedy's obvious failures, his reluctance for civil rights legislation, the Bay of Pigs, Vietnam. He was a C student, and not just at Harvard, but as president. Even Wicker, by the end of the piece, was swept up in Kennedy's genius for self-projection. So with his football coach's will to win and his passion for the ability to do things well, Kennedy has had dreams and realized them, he wrote. But I believe he stood on the sidelines, too, even while the game was going on, measuring his performance and Riley's remarking upon it. Perhaps he knew all along events would control action, which fails to reach ends. There is a certain self-warning to these early accounts. The writers recognized it dimly that our old world was passing in the way of grasping at reality with words. Image that would now be everything. In the face of Kennedy's photogenic command, nothing any mere writer could put on paper would matter much. Mailer, Wicker were watching from the style machinery as it built for the moment, both onside and inside. And that's as much as you can ask for any witness. But everyone who followed with grips in the obsession with Kennedy's iconography. The obsession remains more or less inevitable. No one has been no one has been written about in Esquire more regularly or more thoroughly than John F. Kennedy. Flight from Dallas, Chris Jones, 2013. No one has appeared on more Esquire covers. His photographs are his true legacy. A touch of football with his family. The awkward, sexy conversation with Marilyn Monroe. The pause to fix a cup link at the Ambassador Ball in London in 1938. The unthinking smile from the Lincoln convertible in Dallas just before. No one flipping through these glossy pages cares about what he did or believed or really who he was. He was just too beautiful. Wicker thought Kennedy's capable of watching himself from the sidelines. We're all like that when it comes to Kennedy. It's impossible not to believe, even if you know it's unreal. Time for a little water break. Hold on a second. Okay, turn the page. Love what I've learned. Wisdom and love have nothing to do with each other. Wisdom is staying alive, survival. Love, you're wise if you don't stick your finger in a light plug. Love, you'll stick your finger in anything. As to love, I'm reminded that when I was a child growing up with my grandparents in eastern Kentucky, one morning I was looking out the window and seeing my grandfather walking up the sidewalk. He goes into my grandmother's bedroom. His hands hands her a flower and tells her, "Face looks beautiful, as beautiful like a May morning." To me, that's love. Love is not enough to save a relationship. Gary Shandling, 2003. The most horrendous feeling is to love, is to lose a child. My first daughter, Barbara, was tall, skinny, and had a heart like I had. She went to live with her mom, and she did drugs. And I said, "Barbara, you've got to go to rehab." And she said to me, "I'm not going to do that, Dad, because if I do, then I'm out of all the Chapmans." I'll always remember her as the one who went to rehab because I loved her so much. I didn't make her go. I loved her so much, I loved her to death. It was 2 weeks later, she was killed in a car accident. Forever I will live with, I could have saved her. If you really love them, you've got to really love them. Dwayne Dog Chapman, to January 2009. When I was about to become a father, my friend Burgess Meredith said, "You're going to find something wonderful, someone who will love you more than yourself. For self-centered people, it's a great blessing." Peter Boyle, 2002. When all the dust settles, love covers all. Jesse Jackson, January 2009. Dubious Achievement Awards, 72. Believe it or not, William Hall drilled 7 holes in his head with a power drill and lived. William G. Hall of Shrewsbury, England, killed himself during drilling 8 holes in his head with a power drill. Oh, boy. 1996. We didn't know the old boy had it in her. According to his valet, Prince Charles had sex with Camilla Parker Bowles in the bushes outside a royal residence in Western England while Princess Diana slept inside. Turn the page again. Women we've loved. She was the one with the giant mouth, like Carly Simon, and not that big, but in that big, and only not that big, funny nose too. Linda turned up at the end, has these great eyes too, big dark. look right into them, very warm, on Julia Roberts, March 1989. Everyone in Hollywood has a crossover. Everyone, European Hollywood crossover in the Sophia Loren mold, but Spanish, on Penelope Cruz, 1999. No, we're not going to fall for another obscenely young, tender actress sidling up our subconscious and murmuring, sweet as sin, love me, give me a Tony, make me really famous. Then we saw a prelude to a kiss and thought, anything you want, on Mary Louise Parker, August 1990. If she were going to place a personal ad, it would read, leave me alone, or it might say, looking for a very sweet, very straight night of reckless abandon to do all the things I've never done before. On Angelina Jolie, February 1998. She was a soldier's daughter who admits to being moved by the sound of marching bands. Tilda Swinton, November 1996. Trying to get the page turned again. Euphemisms for male genitalia. Lemons dropped into an old plastic shopping bag. Chris Jones, what kind of underwear should you be wearing? February 2014. A wooden ruler whereupon the mark 6 is incorrectly identified as 7.5 inches. March 7 as 10. The truth about male vanity, March 1997. The dowsing rod of his manhood, Scott Rabb on Don Zimmer's Slow Boil, May 1999. A plug-in industrial drill atop a pair of spherical appendages. Photo from the package, January 2000. Fine bobbing nest of himself, Tom Janode on Mr. Rogers. Can you say that? Can you say hero? November 1998. A cigarro twice as tall as a white-clad man standing between two large fleshy on a large fleshy stem and secondary caudal protrusions. Photo from White Brigade. April 2, 1993. Norman Mailer wrote more than a dozen stories for Esquire, beginning with a short story, The Language of Men, April 1953, including the classic examination of JFK. Superman Comes to the Supermarket, November 1960. Plus a regular column in 1963. He wrote his novel, An American Dream, as a serial under the deadline for the magazine in 1964, but it was especially with editor-chief Harold Hayes, a long fuck-you relationship. In 1970, Dear Harold, about a year ago, some kids started to work for Esquire to Saint came over to me and suggested I do a piece for Esquire on Fidel Castro, and I said, do you know what would happen? I'd spend 2 months getting ready to do it, a lot of time in Cuba, and then I'd work at writing an article for a few months, and maybe it would be the best thing I'd ever done. And then Esquire would print a picture of Fidel Castro on a cover with Richard Nixon's ass installed on his forehead. There's a philosophical gulf between us. Don't you remember how, and even in the good old days, we never knew what to say to each other? Ciao, Norman Mailer. Man in the 70s. God bless you, 70s man. You've got a crow on your shoulder, an eye patch on your face. How did you lose your eye, 70s man? Was it whiskey related? Sledding accident? Did that crow peck it out? You feel comfortable in turtlenecks and plaid and nature. But I'm just happy. But you're just happy sitting atop a plexiglass cube wearing only sunglasses and knee-high socks. You like blondes and a shitload of ice in your drink. You'll have another thanks, sweetheart. 70s man, God bless you for your musky masculinity, your misguided confidence, your sincerity, begetting the Ron Burgundy, the most interesting man in the world, and Swanson, old vice guy, laughing with us once you get, we're laughing with us once you got the joke. Manhood, a recent history. John F. Kennedy, handsome, arrogant, ambitious, egotistical, highly capable, capricious, takes the presidential oath of office. Roger Maris breaks Babe Ruth's single-season home run record. Former fighter pilot John Glenn goes further than any American before him, circling the earth in a capsule the size of a commercial washing machine. Johnny Carson, a vaguely young, safely middle-aged man, takes over the Tonight Show. James Bond, best Dr. No, JFK stares down the Soviets in Cuba. 13 months later, he's murdered. Men everywhere, we little boys watch. LBJ moves into the White House, pissing in the bushes to assert his territorial imperative. Cassius Clay, imperious, beats Sonny Liston and becomes a heavyweight champion. Renames himself Muhammad Ali and refuses to fight in a war he doesn't believe in. Luke Jackson eats 50 hard-boiled eggs. Martin Luther King, graceful and brave, murdered. Bobby Kennedy, murdered. Neil Armstrong takes one small step. Alexander Portnoy masturbates into a calf's liver. A largely pointless but uncomplicated effort. Evel Knievel sets the world record jumping over 19 cars, calling himself afterward the last gladiator of the New Rome. Thomas Eagleton goes to shrink and somehow becomes less of a man. David Bowie appears as a gender dysphoric Ziggy Stardust, ultimately a more culturally resonant figure than Bowie himself. The Godfather premieres, a father and three sons, all four of them end up being assholes, except maybe the Godfather himself, who dies while raising tomatoes. Bobby Riggs taunts Billie Jean King and kisses her in the Battle of the Sexes. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the world's most extraordinary disc jockeys, take down Richard Nixon, thus ending the theater of imperial presidents. Clutchy former Big Ten football player Gerald Ford takes over. The fall of Saigon, America's first-time loser. Bruce Jenner wins gold. Rocky runs the stairs. Jimmy Carter becomes president. Delivers a televised in his sweater. People seem to care. Tony Manero gets down. Albie Singer makes Annie Hall laugh. And Harvey Milk's assassinated in his office. Real loss. Roman Polanski skips town after sleeping with a 13-year-old and never to return from America. No real loss. Ted Kramer, workaholic and ad exec. Imagine some crappy father decides he wants to take care of his son. Well, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, great night, wherever you are. See you next time. Bye.